The War of Influencers. A while back, dear friends, entertainment industry exploded in our faces here in the Western civilization. We're facing the re-election of a president that comes from reality TV in America. Young heroes today arise from the social networks, which in some sense have turned all of our lives into one big reality TV show. Here in Israel, in times of war, the impact of influencers is in some ways unprecedented, at least in the discourse that we are all having about the war. People praise Montana Tucker for wearing a large yellow ribbon to emphasize the terrible plight of the hostages and our demand for them to be released at the Grammy. In other influencers or celebrities like Bella Hadid, Dua Lipa, express positions that are more pro-Palestinians. They are very much criticized here in Israel, of course. What is the meaning of this debate that is happening on social networks and on the entertainment nebulae, wherever it is, to discuss this and more? We are happy to welcome you here at our podcast at Tel Aviv University. Let's begin. And to discuss the war of influencers, I am happy and honored and delighted to host here at our studio Asa Shapira, who's the head of strategy marketing course in the communication department of Tel Aviv University. You have been managing the advertising strategy of some of the leading brands in Israel for more than a decade. You were VP of strategy and a partner at Lead Ogilvy. You specialize in consumer behavior research while integrating insights from cultural research to behavioral economics and evolutionary psychology. And I'm also delighted and honored and moved to host my old friend, Professor Michael Gilad, who is the assistant professor of psychology at Tel Aviv University. You are the principal investigator of the Symbolic Cognition and Interaction Research Group. In the broadest of terms, what that means is that you and your team of researchers try to understand the psychological processes of knowledge construction, i.e. The mechanisms whereby humans understand and predict their reality. Let's start with you, Asa Shapira. In the widest of terms, could you perhaps try to portray this media environment in which statements made by celebrities, influencers, faraway places in the end, have such an impact on the discourse about the war in Israel?
Yeah. Well, I think it starts off with the fact that we look at specifically Gen Zers and people that were born 1994 to 2010. They start consuming the knowledge of the world from social media platforms and not from news media outlets. So social media becomes much more prominent in affecting the knowledge base of a lot of the younger crowds in the world. And the social media platforms, they have their own ways of doing things. The logic of the algorithm pushes us to reassess the way in knowledge prominence throughout social media and influencers that they, as they strive to get attention from these algorithms so they can get people to watch them, they need to adhere to those logical forces of the algorithm. So what they do, they need to become much more vocal, they need to be much more provocative. And in that environment, influencers that strive to get attention, they become much more prominent in their influence on the younger crowd. And the way to get attention from that crowd, they have to be much more provocative and vocal and do a lot of the things that we didn't see beforehand in the public discourse. So the entire public discourse is becoming much more extreme in its essence. In terms of the knowledge base of the younger crowd, because media or social media doesn't really deliver knowledge as much as it deliver strong visuals and strong statements. So we see a rhetoric of provocations and not really a strong debate on the issues themselves. And I think that's the climate where we are now and why we see the influencers in that marketplace pushing the discourse forward with making much more provocative claims that pushes the entire discourse to the extreme.
So would you think that Montana Tucker, for example, wearing the large yellow ribbon, which in over in Israel symbolizes the plight of the hostages and the desire for their release. You think that's a provocation in a way?
Yeah, well, in many ways, she sees herself as a brand, so she needs to. She has been harnessing her Judaism as one of the key factors that differentiate her from other influences. And she saw within, I would imagine, within the conversation that is now going on because of the war of October 7th, she saw an opportunity to push through the clutter of the social media by pushing a provocation that will make her a point in that discussion. So by actually wearing the ribbon and talking about the hostage crisis, in the Grammy, she has managed to break through the clutter and makes people notice her. So because what she strives for is attention. She needs attention as she loses her influence. And the way to do it today is to adhere to the logic of the algorithm. So she needs to be much more provocative. It's not enough for her to just be online and say, look, this is very important stuff that we all need to listen to. In order to make people listen, in order to make the entire world talk about it and prove their point, we're talking about it, okay? She needed to do this provocation. So
what was,
it's a strategy.
When you say celebrities, influencers are brands, what does that mean?
Well, in many ways, what is a brand? A brand is a way for us to hold a place in people's brains where we maintain an association between us and associations about things that derive value that makes people choose us other people. And human brands are just the same as consumer goods. They need to be differentiated so people will choose them instead of others. So Montana Tucker, she has a brand. She needs to differentiate herself from other influencers. So if people say, hey, I would rather look at her and not other influencers, what she needs to do is decide how does she differentiate herself. Montana Tucker, in terms of strategy, she has been using Judaism and the story of her grandparents and the fact that she's a very beautiful person. So she's been managing all these assets to make sure that she will be differentiated from others. And the fact that Judaism is a big part of her brand, she's been using it, obviously, within times of war in order to actually push through and make sure that she's much more known.
But it's interesting that you're kind of assuming a somewhat cynical interpretation of her behavior. You're saying she's using these issues that are very provocative now in America to push through, to differentiate herself, to gain some clout and attention in what is a market that is overexposure of everybody, and it's very difficult to find your own position. Maybe she just really wanted to use the influence that she has been able to gather to push for an issue that's close to her heart.
But why does she gather influence? I mean, why do other people gather influence? Because usually if you have a mission, if you have a vision, you want to push your values through because you want to change the world for the better in the way you see fit. Many of these people, influencers at such, if they don't present us with what they want, all they strive for is the influence itself, because they use it for commercial value. So she can sell herself for other brands and get paid for it. So it's a usage of her assets being a Jew and not the fact that she's trying to push through a message to the world that we all need to adhere to.
But here the message is pay attention to the plight of the hostages, demand their release. It doesn't seem to be a clear commercial interest.
Yeah, because she's using this issue in order to break through the clutter and become more attentive. People will attend to her, and she will gather more influencers that find an emotional chord with what she's saying. She will lose people that don't agree with her, but she will gain more. And then she will use that extra flux of influence to use it for commercial value.
So you don't think there's any genuine attempt at raising awareness to an issue that is, in this example, important?
Might be. All I'm saying is that I come from these discussions with those people, it's always a dual discussion. So you say, it might be very important for her. She is a Jew and she does suffer, I guess, from anti-Semitism around her. and specifically in social media, where,
and you know, she probably really cares about hosted
feeds. Yeah, but it's in many ways, it's just it's an extreme version of what we see around Gen Zs always. It's basically that they go into social media to do what we call virtue signaling. What is virtue signaling? Where I present a concept to the world in order to say something about myself, because I want my friends and my social sphere to feel something about me. So in many ways, it's not very different. It's only in a bigger scale because she has so much influence and so much followers after her.
Isn't it? How is it different from just a politician doing things? Like, if we think of her as a politician, that's what they do. They gain influence also for their private interest, but also to push further agenda.
Well, again, politician would gain that power and will use it to get an electorate, vote him into office, and then he would use that actual power to change the world. To the better or to the worse, that would be depend if you agree with the politician. But the influencer itself, as he tries to gain power, it's mostly he changes the public discourse around the issues he's talking about in the end. But why does he actually strive for that power? What is strive for? And Montana Thatcher have not shown, at least to my knowledge, that she has a bigger vision of what she wants the world to become. Or she wants to get the influence mostly for her commercial values.
Professor Michael Gilad, if we take a step back and ask you, as a professor of psychology, why do you think that it matters so much what influencers and celebrities state, their opinions, what they, you know, the symbolism of their dress in this case? Why does it have such a big influence? How come influencers influence? We are tuned towards looking to where other people are looking. If people are looking, we will look there regardless of what's going on. Influencers have succeeded in getting some initial followership. People are looking. Once they're looking, you would look as well. And this is what politicians have done always, and what society is all about. You have power by people looking at you, and this power can be used to shape society. It's called, in social psychology, it's called the Zsa Gabor effect. You can have
the Zsa Gabor effect.
Yeah. Or the Paris Hilton effect.
Ah, so it's been updated.
Yeah, they updated. I don't know.
Where they need things to be updated again. Like,
yeah, this notion of this, yeah, this the Montana Thatcher effect, maybe. This notion of somebody who's only... value is the fact that
is famous,
is being looked at, and this creates further value, like stocks, like a bubble of because we as species look to other people to understand the world, so we have this really strong orienting mechanism towards where people are looking to seek out information.
I want to say something about it, because I think it's important to this discussion. Why do we see the rise of influencers today? And it comes, I guess, to the matter that mostly young people, they live in a generation where they are immersed with fake news, misinformation, and disinformation, and they have come to distrust the media, they come to distrust politicians, and they strive to have a more a deep, engaging contact with the world. And they see influencers as a way to contact a world which is much more authentic. We have a survey says that 40% of Americans, they follow influencers because they seem to believe that the content they get from influencers is much more authentic than the messaging they get from other media outlets. So the power of influencers in this age comes, I would imagine, from the genuine distrust of the belief that the other media outlets are mostly filled with manipulations.
Why does it matter so much to us here in Israel, Professor Gilad? Would you say these expressions, either of solidarity with the Israeli side of the conflict or with the hostage situation in the case of Montana Thatcher, or why do we care so much about whether Bella Hadid tweets out something that goes somewhat against opposition or Dua Lipa? You know, even ministers get involved with Bella Hadid. So, you know, we're fighting this extremely complicated war, multi-front. We're in the north. There's the in Yemen, in the south, there might be Iran. We're dealing with this incredibly complex situation in Gaza. There's internal strife in Israel, and yet the ministers find time to deal with Bella Hadid as if it's a an incredibly important matter as well.
So, you know, there is a normative aspect to it, right? Let's first get that out of the way. The world is shaped by ideas and by sentiment, and how we are perceived on the global stage will dictate all sorts of war outcomes. So if I'm a minister in the... there is some normative thing about it. But we as readers, as consumers of media, we as humans, we want to be seen, basically. Regardless of these strategic considerations, this is a really fundamental motivation that we have. Motivation to be seen, to be empathized with. Since we're a baby, we start crying, and the mommy comes and takes us and gives us milk. And it's our emotions, our interaction with the world starts from this point of we are in distress, we are in pain, see us. It's fundamental.
So it's a very fundamental, primordial, basic human need where we feel in Israel we're distressed. There's this horrible war. There's this horrible situation with the hostages. And then if someone says, Bono sings something about the victims at the music festival, and everybody feels acknowledged.
Acknowledged. There's lots of talk about this concept of competitive victimhood. Mm. This notion that intractable conflicts in general, the population responds to them by trying to assert their victimhood. I am a victim here. No, I'm a victim here. No, I'm a victim here. Like in a fight between couples, it's not always that good to be in this competitive victim situation, but it's human. That's where people are. Because there is this understanding that pain matters and we want to be seen. Yeah.
Mm. How significant would the both of you think ultimately this aspect of the conflict be to our lives here? You know, the movement of influencers and celebrities from supporting one side to the other. You know, you said that it might eventually the way we are perceived in the world affect the outcome of this war, the conflict, perhaps more generally. How significant do you think this?
I think it comes down to the long-term thinking of Israel, as we see that mostly the people that are being influenced by influencers are Gen Zers, which are a huge group of people that would become much more prominent in terms of their effect on politics in the future. Understanding that their perception of reality around the conflict around Israel is being shaped right now. We understand that this war is not a war to be won now. It's a war to be won now and later on. So for us to not adhere to the fact that if we don't do it now, if we don't fight for their attention and make sure that they see the world the way, at least they see at least our point of view within it, then we might not just lose now, we might lose tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And that is very important for us in terms of strategy.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're often in Israel, we're like a cutting edge. Mm-hmm. In lots of stuff, like cutting edge in we're the first ones to first, I don't know, semi-Western country that experienced suicide terrorism at and here we're really cutting edge because of our geopolitical situation of this idea of like empathy warfare. This it will matter. Democracies are determined by public opinion. Matters in democracies to a certain extent, there is a battle of getting empathy, crying the loudest, being the baby that is most suffering. It's determining now outcomes in the war. It's not just hasbara or like propaganda. It's actually like expressing pain better, and I. It wasn't like this, I think, in the World War II or in the Korea or whatever. Like, it was a war between bad people or bad people and good. Now it's in democracies, emotions have become a battleground.
I've heard a sentence that struck my mind was said that if social media existed in 1945, Nazi Germany would win. Because the way empathy wars is by the sheer number of fatalities that you crunch down and the fact that you see suffering. So you would see Dresden being vanish to the ground. You say, oh my God, we have to stop the war, ceasefire. I mean, some kind of a...
I guess it also depends whether they had access to Facebook and Instagram in Auschwitz, you know, and all in the, yeah. You know, I mean, because
true,
what you would be exposing is not only the bombing of these citizens in Dresden, also the systematic extermination of Jews and Gypsies.
No, but in the end, what you see, you would see an empathy warfare where you would see a German saying, oh my God, my house was burned down in Dresden, and you see a Jew person in Auschwitz, and in the end, someone would call out, okay, let's do a ceasefire. So instead of having a moral statement about the situation, you would say, okay, we saw enough suffering from both sides, let's just stop.
And you know, maybe ceasefire would have worked. You can say that maybe this is a good place we're going to. Maybe this is like mutually assured destruction. So this is mutually assured empathy.
Mutually assured empathy.
Sounds like
assured empathy.
Yeah,
sounds like a pretty good thing.
You know, if the world becomes this place when people are moved by this, including people in Palestine, including people around the world in China, this would cause ceasefires that would be ceasefires. But if we're not still in the end of history, then...
I think that one of the problems, though, is that if you think of it on a purely emotional level without maybe a wider reasoned understanding of the conflict and the situation, is that if we think, for example, in America, a lot of people are very immediately going to respond to the dynamics of the situation in the Middle East based on the American experience. So the Palestinians are going to be the Native Americans. The Israelis are going to be the colonialists. This might have been the case, clearly, in America. The story here is, at the very least, different. It's a different story. It's a different immigration of populations. It's a different dynamic. So if we just take dynamics from foreign cultures but try to understand through them what is happening here, there might be some misunderstanding.
I think the nuances of history are difficult. And in many ways, people's brains seek simplicity. And simplicity is just projection of what you
already know
onto another conflict. So I would not expect the younger crowd over the world, specifically in the United States, to become truly interested within the conflict and learn the nuances of the historical battle between Arabs and Jews. So that would make no sense. What we need to do is understand that the fact that the discourse is being simplified and to the point where it becomes almost stupid, that we need to talk in that same way. If we'll try to be trying to educate, okay, the American crowd or whatever young crowd we're talking about, and becoming much more deliberate in terms of what you need to know so you can understand, what would find that people will just, you know, push back and say, I don't know, I don't want to know. Because we really don't. As much as we don't know anything about other conflicts around the world, we don't know because we have our own lives to live and we don't have time to actually learn stuff. And so we need to understand that's the landscape of the warfare where people don't want to know nothing.
So this battle of emotions, Professor Gilad, it puts us in a very strange situation, and us meaning human civilization, because we've evolved to engage with emotions in face-to-face meetings, in tribal settings, and then suddenly we are facing these screens, these glasses now, right? This headwear, whatever it is becoming. We are facing technologies that engage our emotions in unprecedented ways and very soon in ways that don't have to be even controlled by humans. So basically we are facing technologies that are able to hack into human psychology and direct human behavior and human responses in unprecedented ways.
Yeah, for sure. And people are worried, right, to a certain extent, rightly so. Listen, this is not new, right? People have been writing and thinking about this in communications, in critical theory, the idea that our brains are poisoned by television, that there's a false consciousness that is out there that is biasing our perception of reality, that we're being manipulated. It's always been there. It was always true. The algorithms, are, or not necessarily even the algorithms. The algorithms optimize responsiveness, and they do. But I think the degree to which it's distributed, to which it's on a large scale and fast makes it more efficient, potentially allows you to do really fast experimentations. Think about science. If you want to discover something, you do lots and lots of work. And now you have big data optimization.
Every single moment that we spend on social networks, we are part of an unprecedented, large, wide experiment in directing human behavior.
In what works, and it's like evolution, like viruses, it happens. So yeah, one should be worried that they are being manipulated in a much more professional manner than advertising people were able to do so in the past. Yeah,
and I mean that knowledge used to sell, you know, fast moving consumer goods is one thing. When it's being used to sell politics, sell ideology, to change discourse, and that's another thing. And I think it's a threat to democracies, because democracies has been thriving on the idea that you have a public discourse around a topic and ideas, you know, coming forth, and the public domain within it will discuss what's better for us.
We have no choice but to engage on this battlefield of emotions, because if we try to come with a pedagogical attitude, if you try to come and educate, you'll just be rejected. It's much more efficient to work with emotions. Is that really the case? Do we have no other option? Is there no way of trying to engage with large crowds today in a way that is educational, that leads to reasoned debate?
No, I think that we need to hack the human brain again, but in for democracy. That's a question to be asked, I guess, in our establishment. How one can actually bring through a new landscape where we can reassess how media should work in order to make liberal democracies thrive. Because we know for a fact now, for the last 15 years, that the way media performs and the way it works, it is a sure dooms ground for democracies. And we're just halfway through. And we've seen the rise in populist discourse around the world and populist leaders as they strive to become more extreme in their discourse. And in a way, we have always suffered from the paradox of simplicity, where debates about ideology, which are quite complex, cannot be pronounced in 8-second sound bites. And so usually the ones that win the war sound bite would be the ones that would talk in black and white measures and they will strive to make an emotional response from you. And that's what wins today's markets. So we need to see how we, in a longer term effect, how do we rebuild the landscape in order to make democracies thrive. But in the shorter term, we must make sure that the liberal democracies fight fire with fire. Because if they will try to win simplicity and emotion with complex discussions, they would lose.
Would you agree, Professor Gilad?
No, it's an interesting question. Yeah, I haven't thought of this bluntly. I'm not sure. I think that there is, you know, in general, in life, sometimes... I've seen it even in research, in my research even, that sometimes when a person is extreme, and if you want to convince them to become less extreme, you don't respond by extremism, you respond by being, well, maybe actually, maybe it's the best beer. And it actually works. So it sort of softens you up a bit. So I don't know, I'm generally, you know, left-wing guy. I'm usually against fighting fire with fire. And I think that, yeah, it's possible that if people were to fight, it's true, you have to find a way to do it. You have to find, to hack the brain into... But if you are really principled in and systematic and reasoned and even take into consideration other people's sound bites as the legitimacy that they have, sometimes it does allow you to dispel. Now, how do you capture attention long enough? I don't know. Maybe fewer people should do that. Maybe you just need maybe one of the things you could do is just silence the hasbara, for example, in our situation, let's say in our situation,
hasbara, Hebrew explanation, but it's really the PR.
The PR. So maybe if a country like Israel wants to convey the nuance of the situation, let's agree that there is, to the very least, some nuance in the situation, maybe what should have done is not have that many low level simplistic people shouting everywhere, but rather find the way to force the conversation into some sort of I don't know if it's possible. Perhaps
More complex because discourse. People will tune out. I think that's the problem. I think you think about Generation Z and Generation Alpha. They were born and raised as digital natives. I.e., they were raised by algorithms. So their psyche is different. They have an attention span which is shorter. They have distrust in media and messaging and specifically politicians. So,
but isn't it the case that it's like okay, here a podcast. Okay, podcast is like this longer form. Like this was there was a need for that, right? People are, maybe it's not that natural for people to be bombarded. Maybe they do want some sort of more recent. I don't know. Maybe,
but again, I mean, if I would say how many people are following Montana Taco, and how many people hear our podcast.
I assume that nice one. Montana Tucker is 9 million, so I assume also 8. Oh yeah, we're much larger. but forget this one. If you think about them in long formats, the long formats, the big long formats podcasts, especially in English,
Joe Rogan
or Next Friedman or stuff like that, they get many more audiences so in terms of competition.
But they are the exception, not the rule. Oh, I'm not saying that it does not.
I don't know if they're the exception in terms of how podcasts are like. If you think about podcasts generally, they are long format.
Well, I have no knowledge of the numbers, the sheer numbers, but I would imagine, just by living in my world, that still short form videos get much traction just because it's easier to listen and look at 6 second video.
It's an empirical question.
Than hear 3 hours.
But yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting question. Yeah, in general, sometimes you're fighting fire with fire backfires, and sometimes it's a good thing. I don't know. It's interesting.
But it speaks to the idea that as we look through and to the future of democracies, and how do you build in democracies for Gen Alpha and Gen Z, and that's a question to be asked. I mean, surely we see that the ways and the mechanisms of social media platforms have been destroying the old way of doing stuff. So what's the new way? And we need to solve it fast, because if we don't, the rise of autocratic leaders would be doomed around us.
Well, thank you very much for this wonderful conversation. Clearly, the questions that you raise are questions that we have to deal with as a society, as a civilization in the years to come. And given our human track record, it's probably going to go sour and
zigzag. It will zigzag.
Hopefully, there will be a zag after the zig.
That's not a simple progression.
Yes. But I would like to thank Montana, Di Montana, if you're watching this, I'd like to thank you for wearing the large yellow ribbon, whatever other interests may be at play. First of all, the dress, I think, was a charming dress. And also, I think that whatever position one might have about the current war and the current conflict, more generally, I think that all people with, some kind of human sensitivity would be delighted to see these hostages that have spent already too much time in awful circumstances be released as soon as possible, and hopefully as part of maybe a larger and more hopeful path for all people living here in the region. So thank you very much for your attention. Thank you very much to our guests, Professor Michael Gilad, Asa Shapira. We've been here at Hazira, the podcast of Tel Aviv University. And hopefully see you again soon. Thank you very much. Shalom ולהתראות.